This week on Making Contact.
It's about Compaq and Intel and Hewlett-Packard and all these other companies shutting down their factories in the United States with high wage labor and moving it to China with low cost sweatshop labor and then selling the stuff back into the United States.
Although the advent of so-called free trade has made it much easier for goods and services to cross borders, it hasn't always made life better for average people. On this edition, we'll hear how workers in Ghana are struggling to cope with the pressures of globalization. We'll also take a look at the ballooning United States trade deficit and examine the fair trade label. I'm Amy Pomerleau, your host on Making Contact, an international radio program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. In recent years, the West African nation of Ghana has managed to achieve a number of significant successes. Unlike many of its neighbors, it enjoys peace and political stability. Following its transition from military dictatorship to multi-party government in the 1990s, its maturing democracy is a source of pride for Ghanaians. Yet, despite its achievements, the country is still faced with a range of economic challenges. Correspondent Rupert Cook reports.
A lot of people cannot afford money to go to hospital. I don't know how I live through a month. I think I'll describe that as a magic. So I think the economy is nothing to write home about.
Lydia is a 25-year-old single mother in Accra, the capital of the West African nation of Ghana. She's also a business studies graduate. After leaving university, she found that jobs were scarce. Today, she works as a receptionist, earning the equivalent of around $50 a month. Her predicament is far from unique in Ghana. The country faces massive demographic pressures. Almost two-thirds of the population are under the age of 24. Most youth can only look forward to an indefinite future of unemployment. For graduates, prospects are not much better. Although the country's educational system is one of the best in Africa, there just isn't sufficient employment, even for the well-qualified. Jörg Bergstermann is resident director in Ghana of the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung, a German think tank and NGO promoting good governance.
I'm definitely concerned because those guys who deal with that on a daily basis are saying that a country like Ghana, in order to get out of its poverty, needs a sustainable annual growth rate of 8 to 10% over a long period of time. So far, Ghana has maybe half of that growth rate, which is already also remarkable, but not enough if you really want to get the country out of the situation that it finds itself in.
In many ways, Ghana is typical of most countries on the African continent. There's limited industry. The economy is largely dependent upon commodities. Cocoa, gold, and timber. The raw materials are exported and processed abroad, with Ghana at the lowest rung of the value chain. Ghana's economy is also one of the most liberalized in Africa. The government regularly earns plaudits from the West for its embrace of free trade and commitment to multi-party democracy. Yet globalization and the openness of its markets may also be playing a significant role in hampering economic development. For the congregation of this local church in the rural town of Chifohemang in central Ghana, the sale of their agricultural produce is a matter of sheer survival. About 70% of Ghanaians depend upon farming. Land in the Chifohemang Lower Dinkira district is exceptionally fertile. There's also an abundance of water. Yet this wealth of natural resources is proving increasingly irrelevant for local farmers as they struggle to sell their produce. An influx of imported foodstuffs is undercutting local production. Ghana's shops and markets are full of foreign imports, as well as Ghanaian poultry farmers going out of business due to cheaper imported chicken. Low-cost American rice is also threatening the livelihoods of the country's rice producers. Sam Hansen is the Ghanaian Agriculture Ministry's district director for Chifohemang Lower Dinkira.
For example, it's cheaper to buy imported rice than to buy Ghanaian rice. But the ordinary man goes to the market and he looks for a cheaper commodity. because he doesn't have so much money. He must make the best use of it.
Ghana, the African countries, have a problem, of course, with imports of goods, which often are subsidized one way or the other in their countries of origin.
Jörg Bergstermann from the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung.
Obviously, it may be to the benefit of the average consumer in Ghana if, for instance, he or she can buy milk at a cheaper price than before. If that milk happens to be imported, then so be it. But if you then take into consideration that it may take local milk producers off the market, they don't have an income anymore, and so on. If you put all this on the balance sheet and add it up, whether this then is really still to the benefit of a country, I'm not sure that it is for each and every product range. What it definitely appears to be doing is making it even more difficult for somebody to start a business in such a field where such imports are already commonplace.
Seen from Chifo Hamang, the Western rhetoric of development through economic liberalization and free trade seems somewhat disingenuous. Poultry farmer Daniel Kabwafo.
I think it's a big hypocrisy. You want to develop Africa, you want to develop the poor farmer in Africa, you subsidize your goods, they become cheaply priced, and Africa becomes the dumping place for these cheap goods. And the poor farmer that you claim you want to develop is unable to sell his produce. I mean, where are you taking him to? At the end of the day, the farmer remains poor. The African remains poorer.
Despite the challenges facing agriculture and foodstuffs, there are sectors of Ghana's economy which remain competitive. Although information technology may be a long way from transforming the country, it is bringing both hope and opportunity. There's a fledgling outsourcing industry. New York City parking tickets are processed in Accra. Telecoms customers from Florida are being patched through to Ghanaian call centers. For the investor, there's a highly educated English-speaking workforce with a deeply ingrained culture of courtesy and care, besides thousands of language graduates fluent in French and Spanish. Andrew Esemeze is managing director of the call center company Supra Telecom Ghana, a subsidiary of a Florida-based U.S. telecoms provider.
Based on my own experience, I would say that if you look at Ghana today, you have abundance of human capital. You have a lot of young graduates that are well-trained, who are proficient in the use of English language. All we needed to do was to train them, professionalize this whole idea of hospitality, and tell them and say, look, you guys are great people, but what we're talking about is getting things done, keeping our promises to the customers in a very polite manner. And this politeness is what this guy's got.
Well, I'm on the main floor of the Supra Telecom call center here in the center of Accra, capital of Ghana. It's a fairly nondescript office building, but then inside, a hive of activity as people make and receive calls to and from the United States. There are around 70 agents in here, both men and women, and they're fielding whatever customer requests and questions which their American parent company sends through to them. And I'm with Stella Brew, who's the call center manager here at Supra Telecom. So, Stella, can you tell me, how does this place work?
Well, it's fairly a busy place. We have, on average, 110, 120 agents, and we do take in inbound calls. That's calls from our customers who have requests they need to be taken care of, and we also do outbound calls, which is the telemarketing calls.
Do you see this call center in a certain amount of time fielding calls from the United Kingdom, Ireland, etc.?
To be honest with you, we actually are getting proposals all over the world, I would say, for contracts from other companies. So yes, I am pretty sure that in the next few months, we would be taking calls from clients from the UK, from Australia, from Norway, from all over the place. Yeah.
In the West, call center work isn't considered particularly desirable. There's a high turnover of employees, with many bemoaning its drudgery and low pay. In Ghana, it's the opposite. Call centers are inundated with resumes. A graduate like Lydia might currently earn $50 a month, with 12-hour shifts, 6 days a week. In a call center, he or she can make between $200 and $300, with health benefits and decent working conditions. It seems the perfect combination. Yet controversies over global outsourcing rage in the West, how it's a drain of jobs to the developing world. From the Ghanaian perspective, it's all rather perplexing. On the one hand, there's increasing paranoia in the West about supposedly untrammeled immigration. Yet, at the same time, governments stymie the economic development of countries like Ghana through trade tariffs and massive agricultural subsidies. Andrew Esemeze, Managing Director of Supra Telecom Ghana.
I don't think it's a fair analysis. It's a case of eating your cake and having it. I mean, we are talking about globalization. How can you globalize when you don't open up? Then why can't we open up the US and European markets? On one hand, you have countries in Europe and North America closing their frontiers. They're talking about immigration, mass migration of people, illegal immigration. You have a lot of young people who want to go out there. For me, I think it would be better to have these young people have jobs, create opportunities for them to remain in their countries, work in companies like ours, and earn income rather than they stow away to these countries.
Ghana may be particularly well placed to take advantage of the global trend towards outsourcing. It won't resolve all of Ghana's economic problems and probably can't help the tens of thousands of farmers impoverished by subsidized imports. But it could relieve some of the pressure. At the end of one of my visits to a call center, the manager told me how some of the staff had saved enough to go on vacation to Europe and the US. None of them had tried to emigrate. All had come back to work at the center. Perhaps there lies the sign of real economic empowerment. The choice to stay in your own country. For Making Contact, I'm Rupert Cook in Accra, Ghana.
We'll have more on world trade in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for cassette or CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. The United States is running a record trade deficit, meaning the country imports far more goods than it sells abroad. In a sense, the U.S. is living beyond its means. Economists don't always agree on the root causes of the trade deficit or whether it's necessarily a bad thing. Making Contact's Justin Beck reports on one of the least understood aspects of international trade.
This is the Port of Oakland on the central coast of California. According to the port's media office, roughly $30 billion worth of goods passed through here in 2004. It used to be that more was going out than in. But that's changing, says the port's public relations manager, Marilyn Sandifer.
We've seen a shift in the trend. Previously, we've moved predominantly exports, 60% export, 40% imports, and that's in terms of the volume of goods that come through the seaport. Now what we're seeing is more of a 45-55% shift. That means 55% exports in terms of volume and 45% in terms of imports.
The trend at the seaport is reflected in the overall trade imbalance for the United States, which has risen from $67 billion in 1991 to a record of more than $650 billion today, nearly a tenfold increase. In 2004, U.S. exports declined 3.9%, the biggest drop in 2 years, while imports rose by 9.1%. Economists disagree on whether or not this is a problem at all, and if it is, for whom. Mark Weisbrot of the Center for Economic and Policy Research says those hardest hit in this situation are workers in manufacturing, whose jobs are being outsourced to developing countries.
Obviously, other jobs are created, but they tend to be lower paid, and there's a lot of displacement involved. But it also exerts this enormous downward pressure on wages throughout most of the labor force.
Josh Bivens of the Economic Policy Institute, a nonprofit progressive think tank in Washington, D.C., says running such a huge trade deficit could mean long-term trouble for the U.S. economy, dragging it into recession or, worse, causing a collapse.
We've now got a net foreign debt that is just so staggering, and it's on a pace to ramp up so quickly that, I mean, we really are setting the stage for something truly bad to happen to the U.S. economy over the next couple of years. If foreign investors or even domestic investors decide to leave the U.S. because they've decided our debt is unsustainable, there's going to be a deep recession. Interest rates are going to spike. You're going to see a huge increase in the unemployment rate. And there's just no reason to have backed ourselves into this corner with this trade deficit.
But Benjamin Powell of the Oakland-based Independent Institute, a pro-market think tank, plays down the significance of the $650 billion imbalance.
And it seems like a catastrophic number, a big deal to people. But really, it's actually a creature of accounting. Don't lose any sleep over it. It's actually not an important issue. It's a fun thing to report in the media that it's a big number. But really, it's going to have little to no impact on your life. And overall, it's been good for our economy over the last 25 years.
And Powell says, don't think of it in terms of winners and losers.
It's not a bad for workers, good for rich people type scenario. It's just the result of everybody's decentralized decision-making. Basically, the trade deficit is just summing up everybody's own individual choices of where they wanted to buy from, where they wanted to invest in. If we have the larger trade deficit, more people are investing here. And when more people invest here, then businesses create more jobs, employ more people, and it kind of spreads throughout the economy.
What's good for business is good for people, right? Not according to Kevin Danaher of the progressive San Francisco-based Global Exchange. Rather than thinking about trade in terms of nation states, Danaher says consider who really benefits in all this, the multinational corporations.
It's about Compaq and Intel and Hewlett-Packard and all these other companies shutting down their factories in the United States with high-wage labor and moving it to China with low-cost sweatshop labor and then selling the stuff back into the United States.
What to do about it then? Danaher says the left, for example, has focused too much on policy. He advises instead to take action at the local level.
At the local level, I can get access to the local politicians. At the federal level or even at the state level, unless you're a major donor, you don't have a chance of doing that. But the left has gotten into this thing of policy, policy, policy. Well, you know, that's nice, but it's not effective because we're not in power. You take an economic strategy that focuses at the grassroots, you get local control of the local green economy, and you build up from there so that when you eventually get control of the commanding heights, you've already changed the economy from the grassroots up. It's a much more sustainable approach.
So while those in the U.S. invest in their local economies, what happens to low-paid manufacturing workers in China, for example? With a shrinking market for their exports, how will they survive? Danaher says they'll buy local, too. For Making Contact, I'm Justin Beck.
The process of economic globalization has pushed consumers further away from knowing who grows their food, how and where it's grown, and how production impacts the environment and the people there. But goods with the fair trade label guarantees farmers are paid a fair price by giving them a larger share of the profit, better working conditions, and promoting sustainable growing practices. In the last 5 years, more than 60 million pounds of fair trade certified coffee, tea, cocoa, and fruits have been imported to the U.S., with more than $55 million in extra income going back to farm workers throughout Latin America, Africa, and Asia. Correspondent Vinnie Lombardo looks at fair trade, now that big companies like Dunkin' Donuts and Winn-Dixie supermarkets are carrying certified products.
At the Santa Cruz Coffee Roasting Company, virtually all the espresso drinks and house blends are fair trade certified, as are most of the whole beans sold there. Colleen Crosby, the cafe's co-owner since 1978, says despite all her textbook knowledge, it was in 1999 that she learned about the realities of coffee production.
The bubble burst, and I became a member of the world.
Crosby was at a San Francisco convention of the Specialty Coffee Association of America when she first met a Nicaraguan coffee farmer who told her what plantation life is like. A few weeks later, Crosby visited the coffee-growing regions in Central America, and as she puts it, her life changed forever.
We're starting at the border. We've been traveling for 6 hours. I've been staring out the window, and I'm saying the property isn't stopping. There's no break from the property. And what occurred is I found myself really wanting to connect with the families and with the farmers in a way where it was one human meeting another human.
After returning to the United States, Crosby made a decision to sell almost exclusively fair trade coffees at her three cafes and has become an outspoken advocate, touting the label's benefits. So, what does it mean when a product carries the fair trade label?
First and foremost, you're looking at the kind of conditions that guarantee a decent standard of living, whether the person is a worker or a farmer organized into a cooperative.
Kimberly Eason is Strategic Relations Director at Transfair USA, the nation's only independent third-party certifier of fair trade goods. The fair trade label was initially developed in Europe in the mid-1980s to support coffee farmers and has since grown to include other products. Standards are set by the Fair Trade Labeling Organization, whose board members include some small farmers.
We certify the chain of custody of a product from the farmer all the way up to the manufacturer and assuring that a product that has a label on it, whether it's a bag of coffee, a banana, a mango, tea, chocolate bar, that a product that carries the label actually was traded according to the fair trade criteria, guaranteeing a fair price, that there was a democratic farmer organization behind it, workers on plantations are paid a fair wage and have a right to organize, so that that they meet the fair trade criteria.
Sounds great, but does the fair trade standard go far enough? According to Iris Munguia, First Secretary of Women with the Coalition of Latin American Banana Unions, the answer is no.
Well, if you ask me straight from our experience as banana producers and workers, the fair trade experience isn't exactly all that positive. Obviously, we feel the solidarity of people in paying us an extra price through fair trade so that it goes to the workers. But what we've seen is that this isn't the case. The benefits of the extra price really don't get down to the men and women who do the work. And we haven't had the opportunity for forming unions where we have the fair trade system.
In Honduras, for example, labor laws stipulate that farms with more than 30 workers must have unions represent them. Often, these laws are ignored, or employers will sidestep the requirement by hiring just under the limit. As fair trade certification in the U.S. came about and consumer demand for those products rose, large-scale fair trade operations entered the market, displacing many in the small farm sector. With long workdays in remote fields and little in the way of protective equipment, Munguia believes a higher fair trade standard is what's needed.
Well, in the first place, to respect the minimum agreements of the International Labor Organization when they set up shop within our countries. The farming sector especially can't compete with the subsidized farming that we see in a country like the U.S. But above all, the union movement is prepared to fight for respect for working men and women.
Fair trade certified goods are becoming widely available in the United States. Some 400 U.S. companies are now licensed to sell fair trade products in over 26,000 retail outlets, including familiar places like Dunkin' Donuts, Starbucks, and Pete's Coffee. In December 2004, Winn-Dixie, one of the nation's largest supermarket chains, added a line of fair trade certified coffees. Kimberly Eason of Transfair USA calls this growth a win-win situation.
When larger companies become involved, what they're doing is moving more quantities of a fair trade certified product. They're able to put the product on the shelf in many more points of purchase than smaller companies or smaller chain companies. So you're giving more consumers an opportunity to see the product, to try the product, and then buy more and more of that product.
Quality is often influenced by available infrastructure. Many small and mid-sized farmers are lacking the necessary capital and technical information to offer a product that meets the demands of the fair trade market. This makes survival difficult. Steve Gleisman is director of the Community Agroecology Network, or CAN, a nonprofit based in Santa Cruz, California, working primarily in Latin American coffee-producing regions. To keep up, Gleisman says, some farmers intensified their methods.
You know, add inputs, try to get rid of the shade, try to increase yields. And this usually led to two things. One, debt, and then two, environmental destruction. Add those together, communities start to unravel.
At present, coffee farmers receive $1.26 per pound of fair trade certified beans and $1.41 per pound if it's organic, a far better price than the 55 cents a pound of conventionally grown coffee would fetch. While Gleisman says the fair trade price does help the growers, there are too many brokers involved, so the extra money doesn't stretch far.
You know, the producer probably sells it to a local person who gathers the coffee together. It's a coffee marketer at the local level. Sometimes they're called coyotes by the locals because they don't give a very good price. They bargain a lot, and there aren't other options because the producer isn't connected directly to the market. That's their link. That's who they have to sell to. So then it goes from there to an exporter, from an exporter to an importer, from an importer to a broker, from a broker to a roaster, from a roaster to a retailer, from a retailer finally to a consumer. And every one of those steps costs money. And all of that money stays in the middle, doesn't go back to the producer.
The Community Agroecology Network aims to cut out these intermediaries in the fair trade scheme and give a better price to farmers through a process called direct marketing. For now, CAN only deals with coffee growers, but hopes to soon include other crops. Gleisman admits the benefits of fair trade certification are tangible to some farmers, but reminds those working on sustainability there's more to be accomplished. And Colleen Crosby of the Santa Cruz Coffee Roasting Company agrees.
The challenges are tremendous, from the freeways and people camping there to the slums of Kabari in Nairobi, to when you go up into the mountains of Yirgacheffe and you look at the farmers and you see children with part of their hair missing. And I mean, there's a long haul to go yet, a long haul. This is a beginning. It's a step forward. It's a wonderful step forward. It's not the end of the path.
For Making Contact, I'm Vinnie Lombardo in Santa Cruz, California.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks for listening. Thanks also to production interns Renita Pitts and Shanina Shoemate. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Making Contact is an independent production funded primarily by individual contributors. We are committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. For a cassette or CD copy of the program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Justin Beck, associate producer, Brishen McKee, office manager, Dorian Taylor, outreach and distribution, Peggy Law, founding director, Norman Solomon, senior advisor, David Barsamian, national advisor, and I'm your host and production director, Amy Pomerleau.